My one note is this. You've heard me do this before if you've been to previous last forums, but I don't think that any time is more propitious than now to reiterate this argument. I believe there is a significant danger, notwithstanding the many activities that people are engaged in, both community organizing and campus organizing and many other areas of opposition, which I call protest and resistance, that there's a significant danger that the left, which has been significantly weakened at the minimum for the last 35 years, that there is a danger that the left will disappear. And that disappearance is signaled to a large extent by our virtual exclusion, with some exceptions, from the media. The fact that we don't have, with the exception of Z Magazine, and I call The Nation a magazine of what Bellow calls global social democracy, a little bit to the right of real social democracy, but, global social democracy indeed. They accept the existing framework, and if anybody proposes anything other than the existing framework, they come at them ferociously, even though they have 100,000 readers. That we lack a vehicle, newspapers, magazines, access to television and radio to a large extent, again with some exceptions. And that what we lack in terms of vehicle is a political organization. What is urgent for us is the creation of a new political organization. What's urgent for us is what Thomas Jefferson, and I use Jefferson very deliberately in this regard, regarded as a party. We have Leninist models of a party. We have a Luxembourgist model of a party. We have a Stalinist model of a party. We have the anarchist model of a party. And what a party is a poll of opinion and position and alternative and opposition, which can be in the conversation in the first instance, and secondly, deal with the problem of power. What a political formation or a party does that cannot be done essentially by social movements, however important they are, and I do not want to be interpreted to oppose anything that passes for a social movement. Would that we had a viable anti-war movement in this moment that could call attention to the horrendous policies of this administration on issues such as Afghanistan. I'll talk about that more tonight when we talk about the Obama administration. But whatever that is, we desperately need that kind of an organization. I will not have the time to describe what that organization would look like here, because it's short. But what we literally did have for much of the 1960s was a phalanx of organizations of national scope, the most prominent of which was the Students for a Democratic Society, but by no means the only one, that constituted for a minimum of a decade a significant, visible, viable opposition to existing political institutions of bourgeois democracy. That organization would have to be a radical democratic organization. It would have to be an organization that, with all of its warts, would have to reassert the viability of a socialist alternative. It would have to be an organization that was virulently, by which I mean very, very pointedly anti-capitalist, It would have to be an organization that if it got involved in issues of structural reform, that would be okay. And one of them might be a single-payer health plan. And unremitting opposition to the Obama health plan, unremitting opposition to the foreign policy of this administration. I know how many of you are grateful that the Obama administration is making nice to Cuba. Unremitting opposition to authoritarian regimes, including Cuba. At the same time as asking for diplomatic recognition and trade. It would have to be an organization. It's not a subtle question. It's a question of whether we take ourselves seriously. It's a question as to whether the political unconscious of the left is prepared to come to the surface and develop what I would call a significant ego. Our political unconscious has been to run away from organizations of that kind, a political party. And I don't mean primarily an electoral political party. I mean a political party that can have genuine opposition and alternative to the current operation. How that would happen, who would be involved, how would be involved would be important to discuss. But that discussion is right on the agenda now. Our comrades in Canada have developed that discussion to some extent, even though they don't have this political formation and we don't yet have that discussion. If we do not begin to have that discussion and in a relatively ordered way enter into the process of forming that political party, then I do think we will disappear. And I think to a large extent we have already, to a great degree, disappeared. And unless you want to continue to be invisible in the conversation that goes on, or you want to bitch and moan about the fact that we're not included, then I would urge you to bring your friends together and have that conversation as soon as possible. I will say finally that there will be people who will say to us, it is not the time, who will say to us, isn't it enough that we build the left wing of the Democratic Party and try to push this administration to the left? And there'll be others on the other end who will say to us that we have the line, we have the truth, we are the workers' vanguard, they're giving out leaflets outside. This would not be a political formation that would pretend to be anybody's vanguard. This would be a political formation that would bring together workers and women and people of color and intellectuals and build viable instruments of propaganda, organization, and alternative. And I think the time is now. So that's my contribution, and now I'm going to ask Barbara Epstein to join us.
You need me for what?
I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
Well, I agree with virtually everything that Stanley has just...
Talk into the...
Can you hear me? Good. Okay. I agree with virtually everything that Stanley has just said. I agree that the left is in danger of disappearing. We have to do something about it. I agree that this is a propitious time for beginning to rebuild it. I agree that we need a socialist party, and we need organizations. And so the question is, what does that leave me to say? I will hope that I still have something useful to say. This seemed to me to be a difficult assignment, figuring out a long-term strategy for the left, for two reasons. One is that the situation that we're facing seems to me so volatile that it's not easy to figure out where it's going to go and what we will be dealing with. And, of course, the other thing is that the left is so fragmented and so weak that it's hard to know, if we could figure out a strategy, who would be carrying it out. But I will do my best. It seems to me that what the economic crisis has done has been to destroy the illusion that the so-called free market, supposedly working in the absence of help from the state, which is of course not true, is a kind of perpetual prosperity machine and can be counted on to produce perpetual growth without crises. It's now obvious that there is the danger of severe crisis built into capitalism, and it is no longer the left that has to point this out. I think the situation that we face now is that we can count on the fact that there will be regulation of the financial sector, and there is a recognition of the need for at least some government spending in order to keep the economy going. I think what there is not recognition of is, or maybe another way of putting it, is that the danger is that we could come out of this crisis with a functioning capitalist system, but an even meaner one than the one we have now. I have heard people argue that we are at the beginning of the final crisis of capitalism. I don't think that's true. I think capitalism is going to survive. But I think it is quite possible that there could be regulation of the financial sector, some government spending, but no effort to address the huge and widening gap between the wealthy and everybody else, and very little effort to repair the social services and welfare system that ordinary people depend upon. So I think the question for the left is, how do we make a difference in that situation? How do we push this situation towards a more progressive outcome as opposed to an even meaner outcome? An economist friend of mine tells me that the current crisis began with a Minsky moment, which he defines as a crisis of the financial system, in which speculative assets collapse and investors panic. It then widened into a Keynes moment, in which it is widely recognized that the problem is not just the financial sector, but also the inability of most of the population to spend enough to keep the system going. And he says it could move on to a Marx moment, which I don't need to define. I would say that we have a Keynes moment if we mean by that the need for regulation and for some level of government spending. But I don't think that there's any widespread acceptance that a top-heavy economy in which the gap between the wealthy and everyone else is so extreme is inherently unstable and leads to crisis. And in that sense, that an inegalitarian economy and society is inherently dangerous. And it seems to me that that's the kind of point, that that's an inherently anti-capitalist argument. And if we don't have a strong left, including a strong explicitly socialist left, that argument is not going to be made, and the crisis will not be pushed in the direction of recognizing that issue. Well, so what that leads to is the question of, okay, why don't we have a strong left and why don't we have massive protest? Which, of course, are two separate issues, but they're related. I would say that there are two reasons for the lack of massive protest. The first one is that for 30 years we have had a depoliticizing culture. We created a situation in which there's a kind of common acceptance of the idea that the way one achieves security is through individual efforts. I think that's not merely a matter of false consciousness, but actually the way finance has been structured in this country, that makes a certain amount of sense. And that gets in the way of mobilization. But I also think the fact that we have virtually no organization on the left is a major factor. I would say that sometime in the early 80s, there was a kind of inexplicit decision that was made on the left. It wasn't a matter of people coming together and making this decision, but this decision was nevertheless made all over the country by people involved in social movements that to stop organizing mass membership organizations and instead turn to organizing essentially nonprofits. Stanley talked about the fact that we used to have a massive network of organizations that were based on membership. What we now have is very large numbers of staff-driven organizations in which there's a small staff with a mailing list. And there are supporters, but there is no constituency that is actually involved. That's even true of some of the more activist-oriented organizations. I mean, like United for Peace and Justice, for example, which is really primarily, I think, a network of such organizations. This is not to criticize United for Peace and Justice, but to say that that's what we've got left. And if you don't have membership organizations, that's what a coalition consists of. I think that spontaneous protest is possible. Spontaneous local protest could break out at any moment. But spontaneous protest tends to be local, and it tends to be short-lived. If we want to have massive protest against layoffs, foreclosures, the reduction of social services, and so forth, it seems to me that we have to have organizations. And if we have to want to have a critique of the crisis that points to the basis of this crisis in the structure of capitalism, a socialist organization has to be part of that. So I think we need to begin talking about how we form membership organizations. I think one of the problems, by the way, is that the academic left has become such a large component of the left. And what the academic left does is it disseminates ideas, which is important. But at this point, we need more than disseminating ideas. We need to actually have structures that people can participate in.
Michael Albert.
I'm not even sure who to thank because we don't have the inviter here. But whoever was the inviter for this panel, thank you for having me appear on it.
It was we, the committee, organized the conference.
Well, thank the committee. I feel if this was a panel on vision, on the alternative to capitalism or the alternative to various facets of the life around us, I would feel more comfortable presenting because I would feel like, for better or worse, I at least have a viewpoint that I've developed over time. On long-term strategy, I feel like a rookie trying to say something new. And not just new original, but new for myself, because I haven't really dealt with it. Long-term strategy to me means the framework of thought that we're utilizing to organize our activities in getting from here to somewhere. And the somewhere matters. So for me, long-term strategy, of course, strategy itself is very much time-bound. It's very much place-bound. It's very much context-bound. It keeps changing. So if we're going to talk about long-term strategy, we have to talk about the stuff that is sort of consistent, it will be part of what we're doing. What's part of strategy, even despite time changes, event changes, place changes, is that we have to raise consciousness, we have to do it with constituencies, and we have to develop commitment, on the one hand. We have to contest for change, for reforms, for improvements in people's lives. So we have to win alterations. We have to construct. We have to construct the what becomes a new society, the things where we learn how to operate and what a new society would look like, and we have to construct the vehicles that Stanley was talking about and others that can congeal our will and our power on the road to it. Okay, that's all very vague. It's very vague because I didn't mention a vision. And if you don't know where you're going to, that affects what you do for about consciousness raising and about commitment and about constituencies and about winning reforms and about organization. If your desire is to create social democracy, you'll come up with one set of approaches. If your desire is to create a different kind of society, an anti-capitalist, and that's not what we're not for anti-capitalism, we're for something positive. Call it participatory socialism, call it participatory economics, call it anarchism, call it whatever it is that you desire, but we're for something positive, the strategy leads to it. So what would be the implications for a particular possible goal for those components of strategy? Well, so I like participatory economics. That means I like an economic system, unlike capitalism, in which there's classlessness, in which there's no private ownership of means of production, like everybody probably here agrees, but in which there's something more. There's a change in the division of labor, a change in the way we do work, a change in the way we do decisions, so that everybody, not just 20%, is controlling their own lives, is impacting the decisions that affect them. So we've eliminated the distinction between a set of people who have a monopoly on empowering positions and empowering work and a set of people who are basically carrying out orders. And instead we have an economy which is classless, in which people are have comparable circumstances and have incomes that are a function of how long and how hard they work and the onerousness of their conditions of their work. And I won't go into long details because we only have a very little amount of time. But if one has a vision like this or another one, then consciousness raising means not getting people to be anti-capitalist, but getting people to be pro what it is that we're talking about, to desire, to be positive. It means constituency development, and here I will say something, means that we don't organize a movement that is really a manifestation and an expression of and comfortable for a sector of people that is quite well off, a sector of people that's doing really well, and quite antithetical to, quite uncongenial to, quite disempowering to most of the population. Because of the way it's organized, because of its structure, because of its culture, because of what it disses and what it likes, you know, because it makes fun of everything that working people relate to, sports, religion, and on and on. That's not very helpful. When we fight for something, so suppose we fight for higher wages, or we fight for a redistribution, a budget change, or we fight for affirmative action, or whatever it is we fight for. If it's part of long-term strategy, when we're fighting for it, what makes it non-reformist, what makes it revolutionary, is going to be that we do it differently. It might be the same goal, but we do it in a way that is intended to have people not go home after they win, but to have people empowered and inspired to seek more. So that means if we talk about income, actually, some students at Harvard wrote me a letter not that long ago, it wasn't that long ago, saying they were left students at Harvard, and they were saying there's a move on the campus for the income of the campus police. And they wanted to know how, the person basically said, look, I know I have to support this, but good God, I've got to support raising the salary of the people who are going to then come break up our demonstration. And I don't know how to do this in a way that makes any sense. And I said back, well, what if you were talking about it, you're in favor of it, because they're underpaid, way underpaid. And what if you pointed out how far underpaid they are? What if you pointed out that the professors and the high-end people at Harvard who are earning $100,000 or $120,000, but working in much better conditions and in much better circumstances shouldn't be earning more? Literally shouldn't be earning more. And your demand is a part of a process that's leading to a situation where people are remunerated for how hard they're working and for how long they're working and for the onerousness of conditions of their work, which means that they would turn Harvard upside down and every place else too, because the people in the worst conditions would earn more and not less. In other words, you can talk about even a short-run gain, even a short-run reform, in a manner which is raising consciousness, which would keep striving for more. And that seems to me to be the second implication, that we fight for reforms in a way which is always about our positive aims, our positive aspirations, and which is building desire for them. What about construction, the point that Stanley was emphasizing? And I agree with basically what you were saying. I think there's two kinds of things we need to construct. One, we need to construct institutions which display, in essence, what it is we like, what it is we want. Our institutions tend to display a minor variation on what's all around us often. They are marginally different from corporate institutions in many respects. I know that might sound harsh, but it's true. Stanley mentioned The Nation. It's hard to distinguish The Nation from Newsweek on structure except size. It's not structurally dramatically different. It's not the division of labor is similar, et cetera, et cetera. So we're not putting forward in our institutions an image of what the world we seek should be like. And we should do that. So we should build our own institutions that harbor the seeds of the future and the present. But we also need vehicles. So we need a party, a political organization, some sort of political apparatus which is clear about what it wants and which couches things in terms of its positive vision and which internally, again, we understand that it can't be racist. The left understands that we can't form either institutions, publishing houses, or a political movement that is uncongenial to and disempowering to people based on race or based on gender. But we don't understand that about class. I know we talk about class all the time, but we really don't understand that about class. So we form organizations whose structure and whose implications and whose dues and whose ways of interrelating are not congenial to and don't empower working people, don't create an environment in which they are going to be self-managing, in which it's going to reflect what we desire for a new society. Well, how can we talk about, you know, workers controlling General Motors if workers can't control an anti-war movement or anything that we create? Then why should anybody believe? And it was mentioned, why do people not join the left? Why is the left not bigger? Well, I happen to think it's because there are many reasons, of course, but the reasons that stick in my mind is that we ask people to join us. Come join us. Risk your friends, risk your relationships, maybe risk your job. Come join us. Risk your ability to enjoy TV, your ability to enjoy sports, your ability to enjoy popular culture because you'll be frowned on. Come join us. What will you get? Long meetings, people attacking you over and over again. And not only that, we don't know what we're for. Right? You won't be able to answer the question, what do you want? You'll regard the question, what do you want, as a kind of a negative imposition. So it seems to me we need vision so that we can be for something, strategic notions that will enable us to create a movement that makes people more fulfilled, that literally makes its own members more fulfilled, that provides social arrangements and social interactions so that people's lives get better when they become a part of the left, independently of winning the reforms that improve people's lives. Let me just say one last thing. I think there's another reason why we have trouble. Imagine somebody was going to try and recruit you to a sports team or something. And the person was talking to you, and their manner and their tone and their style made you understand that they thought that they had to lose, that there was no way they could win. You might not join the team. And that's us. I think, sadly, the reality is that it isn't just the American people who are highly skeptical about the likelihood of something good. That's why they don't fight, because why fight to end aging or to fight against gravity, right? It's a useless lost cause. When we say fight against poverty, fight against war, most people think it's silly, it's hopeless, it's part of life. Sadly, I think many people on the left also are very, very dubious about the prospect of winning a new world deep down inside. And if you don't think you can win, then there's no point in spending a lot of time trying to figure out how to fight well, because no matter how well you fight, you lose. So I would say that if we're going to recruit and we're going to do reform struggles in a non-reformist way, in a revolutionary way, if we're going to raise consciousness, if we're going to construct a vehicle, if we're going to construct examples of what we desire, and then we're going to fight, the first thing that we may have to do, many of us, is to look inside and decide that we can, in fact, win. That the problem isn't that they're too big. The problem isn't that they're too violent. The problem isn't even that they have too much media. The problem is that we don't yet know what we're doing. And the minute that we do, we're going to make progress. So we have to work on it and try and do it. Thank you.
That was excellent. That was great. Bill Fletcher, Jr.
Good afternoon. In science fiction, and increasingly in science, there's a theme that you can see in things like the Terminator series or the Sarah Connor Chronicles that revolves around the question of artificial intelligence. And at what point does the artificial intelligence become self-aware? And what you have is this issue within the machinery, within the technology that is able to do things, in fact, able to do a lot of things, but it is not self-aware. And at a certain moment, it becomes self-aware. And the question for humanity is, what will this self-aware system do once it reaches that status? We have yet to become self-aware. We as the left. What we have, in the recent past, and I would argue largely because of the crisis of socialism and not because of psychological problems and other things that we have, but largely because of the crisis of socialism, we have been on the defensive and have allowed ourselves to basically define our being in a left with relationship to particular social movements. But the thing that's unique about a left is the idea that there needs to be an overarching project that goes way beyond the scope of a particular social movement. Because the thing is, every social movement has a left. It does. Every social movement, every progressive social movement has a left. It has a component within it that is trying to push the limits on that particular social movement, both in terms of the way that the social movement functions, but also the objectives of that social movement. That's different, however, from a self-aware left, where individuals and organizations are basically looking upon our task as not being defined by a particular social movement, but by the needs of the whole, and saying that, yes, it's not simply that we're for an end to empire. It's not simply that we're for national self-determination, but we are, in fact, in favor of a different construct. So I would say that when we're thinking about ourselves, we don't have to worry about the left disappearing. There will be a left as long as there is humanity. There will be lefts, I should say, as long as there is humanity. As long as humans are in a struggle against oppressive systems, there will be lefts. The question is whether or not there will be a left, whether there will be a self-aware system of people that have, in fact, that overarching idea, that overarching theory. So I would say that, in fact, is central to who we are and what we need to be. That our dilemma, as I mentioned earlier, to a great extent, is a reflection of the crisis of socialism. And when Barbara was talking about what happened in the early 80s, I would say that in part was a manifestation of the impact that the crisis of socialism had on a certain generation of political activists and organizations. That the crisis did not begin then, but that we were at the tail end of the momentum that came out of the 60s and 70s when many of us thought everything was possible. But we were then grappling with what was it that we were in fact fighting for, and what was the strategy, what was the end point. And at that point, the crisis of socialism rose up and grabbed us on the rear end with fangs, right? And just feel the pain, folks, right? It grabbed us at that moment, right, and pulled us back and pulled us into either giving up entirely, giving up rhetorically, or allowing ourselves to compartmentalize into particular social movements. So what do we need to be doing? Well, I would suggest that we have to be thinking in terms of long-term strategies that are focused on how to and the importance of developing a popular democratic anti-capitalist movement. And with respect to the chiding that we just got from Michael, we're talking about, in fact, a socialist movement for the 21st century. What are the strategies? Well, I would suggest to you that there's three areas, there's three particular components when we're thinking about strategy. Strategy is a plan. One of the things that we in the left have really misunderstood, strategy is not a slogan. It's not a statement. It's not just, you know, we're creating a united front against imperialism or something else. A strategy is, in fact, a plan. It's a plan with a very specific set of objectives, figuring out how you're going to move forces, how you're going to neutralize your opponents in order to accomplish that within a limited or a very specific time period. I'm not going to lay that out. That will be in my next book. But for purposes here, I would say that the strategy needs to involve the fight for local power, a struggle against empire, and the construction of a global environmental front. That those are three central components of the development of a strategy for this moment, because we're not on the verge. It's not like we have a revolutionary movement out there that's on the verge of taking power. We need to fight at the local level. We need to build up our forces where we're engaged in bringing together various social movements in a fight to actually gain power, not simply resisting what the other side is doing, but building a front that is fighting for local power, fighting not simply to get individuals elected, but getting people elected, but also transform the mechanisms of government. That doesn't mean that that leads us into the great socialist future. But I would suggest to you that if we as a left are not engaged in pushing the limits on the Constitution and the limits on electoral politics, we will be forever condemned to be fighting battles of resistance, and ultimately we will be rendered irrelevant. The second thing is anti-empire, that we have both obligation to the rest of this planet to be those that are challenging the empire, but we also to the people in the United States, for people to understand the ramifications, in fact, of empire. One of the concrete things we need to be fighting as a reform struggle around the need for a democratic foreign policy. And that means that we support certain things that are done, such as when President Obama walks across the room and greets President Chavez. We should applaud that. That is exactly what he should do. But it is not enough. And when he does other things, such as is either silent on the atrocities being committed by the Israelis in Palestine, or when he is talking about redeploying to Afghanistan, we must speak up, but we've got to do both. We on the left like to criticize, but we don't like to speak up when bourgeois politicians are actually doing what they need to be doing, because we have to, in fact, speak up in response to that. The third thing is a global environmental front. There are a variety of forces, and see, the moment that we're living in of an economic crisis and an environmental crisis raises a question. And it, in fact, does raise the question about the survival of humanity. Capitalism will more than likely not collapse on its own. But the decline of capitalism combined with the environmental devastation raises some very fundamental questions about whether humanity will continue to be able to live on the surface of this planet. Not necessarily whether it will disappear entirely, but as I've been saying, whether Isaac Asimov was, in fact, prescient when he talked about caves of steel and humans living underground, which will mean a very, very undemocratic system. We've got to be thinking about a global environmental front and who are the forces, many of whom are not going to be socialists, that need to be drawn into such a front in order to fight for the saving of humanity. Following from these, it seems to me we've got four tasks. One that was laid out by previous speakers is that we need a party. We need a party for socialism. We need a party that puts the issue of socialism, in fact, on the agenda and makes that, in fact, relevant. And it's interesting because there are these polls going on that I'm actually stunned by, where you have phenomenal numbers of people that are saying, well, capitalism isn't so good and socialism maybe should be given a chance. Now, let's leave aside. I don't want everyone to just get overly happy about this, right? Because when people are saying that they're for socialism, they don't necessarily mean the same thing that everyone in this room does. And when people say they're critical of capitalism, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're critical of capitalism. They may not like the bankers and a lot of other things. But what's important about this is that folks are saying that they're willing to think outside of a box that only a year ago they would never have imagined that they would have. It allows us tremendous possibilities, but we have no organizational means to step up to the plate and take advantage of that situation. So that's one task. The second task, which is directly related, which is the nationalization of resistance struggles. Now, what do I mean by that? By nationalization of resistance struggles, I'm saying that part of the problem that we've been witnessing, certainly since the early 1980s, is a proliferation of tremendous and heroic struggles. Some win, most lose. Tremendous heroic struggles that do not necessarily translate into some sort of cascade. The workers that took over Republic Windows in Chicago, wonderful struggle, wonderful victory. Where have the countless worker seizures of factories been since? The problem is not that workers aren't prepared to fight, but it relates to something that Michael was saying. If people don't have a sense that they can win, if people are not linked to others and start to feel the strength from that larger mass, those struggles will be limited. They will be heroic. The Staley workers were heroic. They lost. There are other struggles in Watsonville, California. Heroic struggles, but they don't necessarily become nationalized. Part of our task as a left must be to nationalize struggles. Third, we need to link our electoral action with the fight for structural reforms. Stanley mentioned one in terms of health care, but there are others. We need to be thinking about deepening when President Obama is talking about the stimulus and green jobs. Absolutely, President Obama. And now we've got to push the limit on this. My friend Sam Gindin from Canada talks about the need for government to buy up these abandoned factories, right, and start retooling them, turning them into means to produce the things that need to be done. These are the demands that we on the left should be taking up, and we should not be waiting for liberals to advance this. And finally, global linkages, and there's much to be said about this. Many of us are focused, obviously, on Iraq and Afghanistan, but I want to say that for the United States, there are two flashpoints that we on the left have to become much deeper on in terms of explaining the importance and building solidarity. One is Palestine, the other is Mexico. With Palestine, as the saying goes, the road to peace goes through Jerusalem, right? There will be no peace on this planet until the Palestinian question is settled with justice and self-determination for the Palestinian people. It will not happen. And we in the United States have a particular duty to undermine every effort by this government to give uncritical support to the Israeli atrocities going on every day against the Palestinian people. We also have a task when it comes to Mexico. Mexico is imploding. And it's not simply the narco-terrorists and that war that's going on, but there's a mass struggle of the people for democracy, for equality, for redistribution of the wealth. And we need to be involved with that. What happens in Mexico will send ripples through the rest of North America. So we have a special duty to the people of Mexico who lost half of their country in 1848 to the United States, to the people of Mexico that the United States has always tried to turn into a neo-colony. Our left must think in terms of Palestine, Mexico, as obviously with the rest of the planet. But those are the two flashpoints. Thank you very much.
Well, we have an hour, and you should be thankful to the panelists for providing that hour, because they were disciplined, asked to speak for 15 minutes, and none of them spoke for more than 15 minutes. So congratulations. Now, what I'm going to suggest is that we entertain three questions and then have the panel respond, and then another three questions. And I'm glad that Richard Healy agrees with me. It's very important whenever he agrees with me. he's even shaking his head. So,
Stanley, you
yes?
don't want to immediately get audience.
What'd you say?
You don't want to immediately get
I
audience.
I said, let's ask three questions.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, or three comments. But remember, the comments should be no more than 1 minute because you have other people. Yes. Maybe you ought to go to the mic. We have microphones here. We have two of them. Yeah.
There are many people that I've been reading, including some liberals like Krugman and Robert Reich, but also progressives, leftists, who've put forward all kinds of alternative proposals, economic proposals to the current bailout scheme. What possibility is, especially since you on the panel are more in touch with these famous people, of getting them together to form some kind of collective, unified platform, economic alternative for progressives, and then within that broad movement, we could have some of the kinds of things you've been talking about emerge, a socialist party and so forth.
I'm gonna alternate, yes, and then why don't you stand behind one or two of these things and it'll be easier if you're gonna guess. Yes, go ahead.
Yes. I wanted to follow up on Bill Fletcher's last thing about the foreign policy issues. It's great to see Chavez and Obama shaking hands and talking about improving relations with Cuba. So you see some melting there, but you don't see it around the Middle East and around Israel. How the hell are we going to move our Congress and our administration on Israel? And if I could just say, if anybody's interested in going to Gaza and setting up camp on both the Israeli and the Egyptian side, trying to break the siege, please see me, and I have flyers for it. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Name is Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party. To me, strategy, both short and long term, needs to flow from what you're dealing with. And we're dealing with an imperialist system, starvation and disease in much of the world, and that's in the structure of imperialism. So we're not just dealing with the inequalities in the U.S., and I think that needs to be much more squarely and focused in the left forum. But also, to me, what that poses is humanity needs revolution. We need to get out from under imperialism, and then that poses an approach from that. Now, yes, there is no party or any force ready to take power through revolution in this country, but how do you get from here to there? And I do not believe it's going to be through Obama. Look, Obama does everything, including greeting Chavez, from the perspective of how do you save imperialism and U.S. hegemony within that. And that is no good for the people of the world, and we shouldn't be into that. And I think it is a question of promoting, in the midst of this crisis, that revolution and socialism transitioning to communism is a solution for this, which is what we do through the pages of Revolution newspaper and do every day. Now, you got to link that to the masses, including taking that into struggles that the masses are waging. But that needs to be out there, and this is a time for it, because people got a lot of questions about where capitalism can go, and that's
thank
probably
you, thank
my
you
minute.
Very much. Panel, quickly.
Start with somebody else.
You want to take more questions?
What do you think, Bill? More questions?
Let's take more questions. Yes.
I would ask the panel about actually existing unions or revitalized unions. We talked a lot about an organization, a national organization, an organization that would give something positive to its members. So it seems you've got a kind of model, and yet people didn't really, and the panel didn't really dig into that. And I wonder if you think it's... I'd like to hear your reactions to the idea of kind of building or transforming a union model for this kind of organization of the left that you like.
Sir?
Well, Frieder Wolf from Berlin.
You'll have to speak into the microphone to be heard.
Well, now?
Yep.
Just one basic question. I think there is a strong tendency in the left not to discuss about strategy, but about tactics. And whenever strategic issues are addressed, we are at once shifting into discussing tactical examples. So I think we should make an effort of abstraction, not just discussing American politics or German or whichever, but discussing on vision, where do we want to go, which are the alliance partners we need, which are the enemy forces, and how do we relate to the present urgency? We have a constellation of crises which I think doesn't make it possible to say, well, in the long term, the masses will understand what we have been telling them all the time. We have to rethink our message so as to address this urgency. And this does not allow anymore a strategy of saying, well, wonderful, crisis is making things worse. This will wake up the masses. It won't. Because anti-capitalism, to be unpopular, is also a right-wing thing. The Nazis were, in important rhetorical, ideological respects, anti-capitalists. And this is, again, a danger.
Let's take one more and then have the first round, because there'll be six questions. Yeah.
It seemed everyone agreed on the need for some kind of organization. So my question would be, what steps do we take to get closer to having that organization? And particularly, what role can something like the Left Forum play in getting there, more than just saying at a panel it's a good idea?
Okay. Panel, anybody? Well, I will start, because I was the first one to speak, and I was quite limited in what I wanted to say and what I said. I'll start with the discussion of vision. I don't think that on a global level, as well as in the United States, we have an adequate vision of what we mean by the good life or by the new society that we would like to construct. And let me suggest, with all due respect to the significance of changing relationships of ownership and control of the means of production, which I'm entirely for, that that's not the core of a new vision. That either that's a means for a new vision or for a new society, or it becomes, as it did in the Soviet Union and for a long time in China, it becomes a dead end. I'm a follower, or at least I've been deeply influenced by Marx. And one of the things that I learned from Marx was what an Austrian Ernst Fischer calls the dream of the whole man. The term man here should be taken, the dream of the whole human. We want to change the relations between human beings, relations between men and women. We want to change the culture. And if you don't change the culture, you ain't doing very much. What we know from the history of socialism is that when they succeed in winning power, they succeed only in taking the first step. And it doesn't. And unless that vision is continuous with winning power, and then they're going to be in trouble. The second problem that I think is important, and I'm only going to talk about one thing again because I think other people, is that I don't think we have an adequate understanding of the state. I'm not for taking state power. Start there. I'm really not. And I think we will have that debate in this kind of formation that I've urged, because I think there will be people who will see the state in a very long-term transition as a necessary step. I think that's got to be, at the very least, debated. The state is the problem, not the solution. And that doesn't mean that I'm not for single-payer health care. No, I think you have to understand the distinction, because we have to begin to address very, very significant historical and theoretical questions. And the third part of that vision is that we have to come to terms with what C. Wright Mills called the cultural apparatus, and what Adorno and Horkheimer called the culture industry, and what it has done to people. And so I agree with Michael fully that sports and dancing, I'm a follower of Emma Goldman on that question, no dancing, no revolution. Sports and dancing are part of what we need, but we have had a very long period in which that cultural apparatus, which includes technology, has been a source of subordination of masses of people. So we have to have a perspective on the technology. We have to have a perspective on the culture industry and what is culture and what does it mean? And do we have anything like a popular culture anymore? Anyway, these are some of the questions that go into vision. And I would argue that while this is a time when the economic situation seems to be all pervasive, it would be a truly radical act if we actually began to discuss the question of vision. Truly radical act, because that's what is not expected of the left, because the left is only expected to be anti. Yes, Barbara.
Okay. Well, what Michael and Stanley have focused on is that we need a vision. And the absence of a clear vision and its impact on the left.
You got to talk in to the microphone.
Sorry. It seems to me that we do have a vision to some extent. It's not well enough worked out. But I think we would all agree that we want a society that is egalitarian on all levels. That means economic as well as political, around issues of race and gender and so forth. And what's new for many of us is that we also want a society that is environmentally sustainable. As Bill pointed out, that's absolutely crucial. I think the question for the ability of people to listen to us is not only whether we have a vision, but whether it's believable. Whether it's linked to current struggles, because if we can only put forward a vision of the society that we would want and not be able to link it to struggles that people can imagine being engaged in right now, it doesn't go anywhere. And that's the reason why I think that the current economic crisis does open up opportunities, because we can point out that it's the deeply inegalitarian nature of our society, and also its massive environmental problems that have led to the situation that we find ourselves in. And so we can address those issues both specifically right now and also put forward a larger vision. So I do think we have to work on those connections. What the specific organizational vehicles are, I don't know. And I think part of the problem with that is that, generally speaking, those organizations are built among people who are already in the same arenas. You know, in the 30s, people working in the factories. In the 60s, the campuses were the arenas for those organizations. Whether it could now be, for instance, neighborhoods, community organizations, I'm not sure, but I think that's really what we have to begin to explore.
Going back to the first question, I think the first question was, could there be a unified economic program in response to what's going on? I don't see the person who asked it, but in any case, the answer I think is no, and the reason why there can't is because there's going to be at least two, probably more, but at least two broad programs. One will be a social democratic program that basically assumes capitalism but seeks a amelioration of the problems. That's the motive of the people who are the good people in that group. And there's another set of people in that group who are basically looking at the world and saying the only way we can stay on top is if we change things sufficiently so that the system continues to function along, a lot about what Walden was talking about. And then there'll be another approach which will say, look, when the reason why there's a rippling crisis is because there's a disruption and then people are unemployed, and when they're unemployed they can't buy and there's a disruption, so you have to stop unemployment. Okay, fine, pass a rule against firing people. You pass a law against firing people, the owner can't fire people, but they can't produce as much, so what do? Fine, cut back the number of hours but keep paying people the same amount they were getting before. You cut back the number of hours, you're paying people what they were getting before, producing less because the economy is down, profits take a nosedive. Too bad. If profits take a nosedive and the owner doesn't want to function under those circumstances, that's fine. Take a hike, nationalize, and turn it over to the workers. That would be a left approach to unemployment. and to firing. No more firing, no more pink slips. If you have to cut back, cut the hour, et cetera, et cetera. Now, you can imagine that on everything, on housing and everything else. That would be a radical kind of program, and somebody else could come up with it better, too, at least. And the next question was about Obama. Well, you know, I just think Obama is at best a little bit on the humane side of that social democratic agenda, largely on the preserve capitalism side, and that's at best. More likely, I fear, maybe Walden is wrong and he could be just trying to get back to business as usual. My real comment about crisis is the word makes me a little ill. The reason it makes me ill is because the reason that what we have now is called a crisis is because it affects the rich and the powerful. Before this crisis, there were tens of millions of people starving to death around the world. There were 30 million poor people in the United States and 7 million homeless people. That business as usual is not a crisis. Yeah. That's not a crisis, because the only people hurt are people, are normal folks. What makes this a crisis is that they're paying a price a little bit. As soon as it's a little bit them, then we all have to figure out what to do about it. Now, I'm not saying that this could make it worse for everybody. Of course, I know. But there's just something about it that, anyway. There was a question about what steps do you do to have an organization? Well, if an organization is a revolutionary organization on the left, it's going to have a vision. So one thing you do is you have to get shared vision. You can't do that unless you have a big discussion of what it is we want on all spheres of life in a manner that is accessible to and can be owned by normal people and is related to what they, you know, the terminology that they can deal with and everything else. And there's no reason why you can't do that, because the obscureness is not because it's that difficult. It's for other reasons, I think. So you have to do that, and then you have to develop locally, and you have to federate into something that's bigger. Those are the steps. Vision, strategy, program, local organization. Bigger. If part of our vision is that workers in workplaces and people in communities are going to be organized together and control their own lives, like assemblies in Argentina, then we start forming those things. It isn't just a big party we have to form. It's the beginning of local councils or assemblies or whatever you want to call them. And finally, this question about, there was a lot of discussion about the question of vision. Now I won't talk much about that. I don't have much time. But it seems to me it is not vision to say, we want freedom, we want justice, we want equity, we want people to control their own lives. Bill Clinton could get up here and say that stuff and do it more eloquently and movingly than most of the people on the left and probably most of us. And none of us would buy a minute of it. Why? Because we know that the institutions that he favors are contrary to what he would be saying he's for. A vision that is convincing is going to be an institutional picture of what delivers on those values. If you don't have the institutions, we're not much different than some mainstream person saying, I'm for wonderful things. But there's no belief. And if our own institutional structures put the lie to our values, then the public doesn't believe us any more than we believe Clinton. I think that's, and so I think we have to have an institutional vision, and then we have to put the seeds of that into our practice, into our organizations, into our struggles.
I would actually love to respond to all of these questions, but in interest of time,
me too.
Let me just say something about this, first about this economic platform issue, because I have a somewhat different position. In listening to what Carl was raising about Obama, I started actually thinking about Malcolm X, and I was thinking about this dilemma that Malcolm faced in the Nation of Islam, because the Nation of Islam had a very apocalyptic view of the United States and of the future, and basically felt like nothing could be done, and therefore what we have to do is, as African Americans, embrace that particular variant of Islam and strengthen our community and essentially wait for the shit to collapse, right? And then we would, like the phoenix bird, emerge out of the ashes. And Malcolm found this incredibly frustrating, because masses of black folks were in the streets in the civil rights struggle fighting for reforms that would not fundamentally end the national oppression of African Americans, but were nevertheless essential struggles to be engaged in. And he made this decision in leaving the Nation of Islam that that's where he needed to be. And I feel the same way about the economic reform issues, that there are programs that are being advanced that are not what I think will resolve things. I don't think that anything resolves the misery people are feeling under capitalism until it's ended. But the reality is that we are not anywhere close to winning power. And in that situation, the question is, are there reform struggles that we fight for where we can engage masses of people moving forward and, in fact, through that process, start to rethink some of the basic precepts of the economic situation? I think they are. So with respect to what was being raised, I do think that there are some liberal to social democratic economists like Stiglitz and Krugman that we should be working with. No, they do not have our platform. So what? Right? We want to disrupt the other side. We want to be creating fissures on the other side. And we want to be moving people to be thinking outside of the box. And I think that that helps, even though it's not necessarily our program. And we can nevertheless raise our issues. Because what we have to do, in the words of the old man, is to always think about who stands to gain. The issue is not Obama. The question is, when he does something right, who stands to gain, right? It's not about whether we think that Obama is Merlin the magician. It's who stands to gain if there's thawing of relations with Cuba. You know, who stands to gain if they start to reveal these atrocities Bush was carrying out? Who stands to gain? Do we just sit back and say, it's not enough, right? Well, that is basically going to condemn us to complete marginalization. Just last point, because we don't have time to go into the rest. Medea's question about Palestine and Israel seems to me that part of what we're up against is that we basically, when it comes to Palestine in the United States, lack a broad enough front around this that's deep enough, that really touches the key constituencies that can be mobilized around this. We also... Have often a narrow view. So, for example, the current debate that's going on among Palestinians about one state versus two state is a very important debate for the Palestinians. Our debate needs to be a debate about the occupation. It needs to be a debate about the U.S. complicity in the occupation. To the extent to which we North Americans engage in the debate of one state versus two state, or up the ante on that debate, it's not simply engaging as good partners, but we become almost like social imperialists in this, in essentially insisting on a certain point of view when it's not our struggle. Our struggle is against the particular demon that reinforces the atrocities being committed on the Palestinian people. So we've got to be thinking about how do we build, in fact, a very broad front that shifts the debate. And it is starting to happen. I mean, many people may not want to hear this, but Jimmy Carter's book was one of the most important things to circulate in the last number of years in shifting. The title alone, even if you didn't read the book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid, really shook, you know, many of the anti-Palestinian forces in a very fundamental way. We've got to deepen it. Our role on the left is not to rely on Jimmy Carter, but to take advantage of the opening that we saw there. So I think we've got to be thinking about a broad movement where we're not always up in ante, but where the basic price of admission to this movement is simple. Are you in favor of the occupation and the subordination of the Palestinian people? If the answer to that question is no, then you have a place in this tent.
Thank you. Yes.
I'd just like to make a comment with respect to changing this country's policy on Israel and Palestine, and that is to recognize the extent to which this nation has been taken over by Zionists and, to a lesser extent, the Mossad. I'm talking about the infiltration not only in government structures, and like Zionist fascists like Rahm Emanuel, and Mossad infiltration into various political and government structures, also Zionist money that virtually everyone, in starting from the president and Congress and the Senate, are financed by Zionist and corporate money. And I think the core issue for the left, I agree with you, Stanley, that the state is the problem, but we can't fight it and we can't ignore it, but we can transform it if our core issue is public financing of elections, because then we can elect activists, then we can implement our vision of protecting the environment and having the state serve the people instead of the other way around. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Professor Aronowitz, last.
Well, he wants to Bill wants to respond to that.
I'm sorry, this is breaking protocol, but with all due respect, see, we've got to be very careful about anti-Semitism within our ranks. And No, we've got to be very careful. See, there's one thing to talk about the alliance between U.S. imperialism and the Zionists. There's absolutely no question about that. But we've got to be very careful. There's a whole wing of people, the extreme right, I'm not accusing you of that, but the talk about a Zionist occupation government that really touches on a certain historic anti-Semitic theme that is run in the United States and Europe about Jewish bankers and wealthy people, and particularly any time there's a financial crisis, the right starts going after Jews and looking for them under every bed. And so I think that we've got to understand that what's going on between the United States and Israel, yes, there is a Zionist lobby. There's no question about that. Very strong. And that intimidates people. But let's understand where the tail is and where the dog is, right? The U.S. looks at and needs Israel. The U.S. needs Israel, and they need it for particular strategic objectives in the Middle East and elsewhere. The issue that we're facing is not primarily about the infiltration of the Mossad and the Zionists here. You know, when you look at the character, the demographic character of the U.S. ruling elite, it is not overwhelmingly Jewish. It is not overwhelmingly Jewish. That is not what we're dealing with. It's not overwhelmingly Zionist. And so the reason I ask Stanley, and I appreciate this, is that when we start hearing things that start flirting regardless of intentions, that start flirting with this anti-Semitism, we've got to stop it, we've got to clamp down, because the reality is that those of us that are supporting self-determination for the Palestinian people are beat up all the time about alleged anti-Semitism. We've got to distinguish our politics from this other stuff.
Yes, go ahead, Barbara, go ahead.
Professor Aronowitz, last year I had the privilege of addressing you about the growing secessionist movement in the United States. At that time, it was based primarily in New England, in the Middlebury Institute, and some of the conferences they were holding. Last week, the governor of Texas announced that perhaps secession should be on the agenda. Now, to describe the governor of Texas as anywhere unsympathetic with the views of this conference, of course, is ridiculous. He was grandstanding. But the point being is that secession is right. Secessionist fears, secessionist movements, secessionist thinking is growing in the United States, and the left has to be prepared to address it and take a position on it. Now, the conclusion, the grow on what this woman just said, there are geographical and sectionalist interests in the United States who identify, regrettably and untrue as it is, but Washington as a power center, no longer answering their needs, and New York City as a sectionalist geographic center that has exploited them and destroyed the wealth that they worked so hard all their lives for. This has a geographic dimension and has a sectionalist dimension. Secession is on the agenda. The center will not hold. What do we do as progressives living in our various areas? Thank you.
Okay. Did you want to say something, Barbara?
Oh, okay, I wanted to add something to what Bill said, which is that I agree with Bill that the issue is the occupation, and I think that there is a shift going on in relation to that among Jews in the United States. I think what's happened, particularly as a result of the attack on Gaza, is that there has been a right-wing shift in Israel, which I hope will change, and there has been a left-wing shift in the Jewish community in the United States, particularly among younger Jews, but I think also generally. And I think that what we need to do is to encourage that, foster it. My impression is that what the peace movement in Israel is looking to at this point is the United States. That's where they now see the hope coming from. And so, you know, as we talk about a politics of alliances, which is what we've been talking about on this panel, I think that's very important in relation to the Middle East. And I think it's important not to use the kind of rhetoric that disrupts the emergence of those alliances.
Sure.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to mention two points. I hope they interrelate and not are scattered. But anyway, you know, people a lot of times when they see somebody on a bully pulpit, you know, hacking away a newspaper, you know, they roll their eyes, they chuckle to themselves, and they probably should, because that's sort of outdated methodology, and it's problematic, right? It just makes us look pretty bad in the left when we're in these situations. However, the sort of soft sell, too, that, like, sort of has taken, like, there has been mass organizations and so forth that become very inwardly focused, self-cultivated sort of, like, groupings, and that are actually not worth time either. And I, like, and this is sort of just one problem I was sort of having in, like, listening to, I guess, the speaker panels, the overemphasis maybe on theory. It strikes me that we have way too much theory, in fact. I mean, like, we mentioned before, intellectuals, left-wing intellectuals are more pervasive through the movement than actually the movement is. And so there's a proliferation of ideas, and I'm not trying to sound Philistine, but to use sort of the Louis Althusser point, you know, theory lags the practice. If we don't actually have a movement to actually, you know, take advantage of the objective conditions to challenge this this administration, this state, then we're just going to lose out in a way that is, you know, bad. I mean, like, the government itself realizes that right-wing fascism right now is much more of a threat than the left-wing. I mean, we have the recent report about Obama is, like, essentially, like, right-wing people taking advantage of the objective conditions that, you know, people, GIs and so forth, are going to be mad about losing their houses. I mean, stuff like this, which is really real. And I just think that sort of, like, this focus on mainly sort of a theoretical speculative aspect about how we're going to project ourselves into communism is just kind of already what has been done for a long part of our history. I think most importantly, we have to start beginning to think about building strategic unity on the left, and, you know, actually challenge the system. That's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope that I would have not addressed that issue. And I was going to address something more fundamental to the subject. But the speaker who stood here before me repeated in the subtext of what he said the same vile issues that Bill Fletcher tried so eloquently criticized. Those New York, parentheses, Jews, and Washington, you know, who are against us, real Americans, et cetera, et cetera. It's vile, and whatever we disagree about, and Bill Fletcher and I may disagree about the Arab-Israeli conflict, there is no room on the left for this kind of talk. And let me say something, not only because it is wrong, it is bad for the left. It turns away decent people who, when they hear that, they associate the left with such talk. We do have our disagreement, and I'm not going to enter into how to resolve the Palestine issue. And now, here is what I was going to speak about, and I'll be quick. Stanley, again and again, I never, that presentation spoke about the need for that party organization that we must have. Barbara elaborated on it. I see on this panel two people who are probably former members of DSA, one who is at least a nominal member of DSA, and one who is of another flavor. Not that you should belong to DSA and be active in DSA. DSA is a sorry organization, and from the inside I'm critical of it. But we did have that vehicle. What, and if not that, why not the committees of correspondence that decent people attempted to form a further, quote-unquote, left alternative? And if not, over all these years. Why not? And I would say, because too many of them are consumers of leftist politics. We subscribe to all those magazines and listen to some of those radios and television programs and upload. But it is messy to be involved in a membership organization. And something else, and I'm going to be finished, there are problems with being members of a membership organization in the 21st century, in the late 20th century, and sociologists wrote about it. And the point is, we do have that organization, or we did, and if not, it could have been, they could have been formed, and there are real reasons why they don't. It is problematic to have such functioning organizations.
Those are good questions. Yes.
So I come to the Left Forum every year, and people
speak
that I
into the microphone.
People that I respect a lot, whose books are on my bookshelf, and who are the reason that I came to the conference, say we need a new socialist party, and everybody kind of nods along and gets excited for a moment, and then we go home and get back to our lives. And you know, I think that part of the reason that we shifted as a left to magazine subscribers and nonprofits and mailing lists is that we as socialists irritate the shit out of each other. And what holds us back from actually forming a new organization is that we don't just fear, we're certain that it will devolve into a convention like this where people stand up and grandstand on their pet issue. Bunch of ultra-left organizations trying, you know, selling their magazine and trying to capture the awesome machinery of this modest organization. And as the comrade who spoke before me said, it's messy to be a part of a membership organization like this, and people will be gunning after you, specifically denouncing you and publishing leaflets about you and things like that. So I'm not sure how to avoid those problems. It seems that to form that next organization is something of a process, and it might require a steering committee or, God help us, a think tank or blogs or something with a national identity that people can kind of coalesce around. But it certainly requires leadership and your leadership, because if the folks at this table and the 40 or 50 names that we could all rattle off, you know, our favorite, you know, leftist writers and intellectuals and union leaders, whatever, put out a call, or if you right now did, and we passed the hat around just this room, we could probably raise a couple $1,000s for, you know, whatever that next step is. If you handed out a sign-up list, you'd get a bunch of volunteer organizers. But it does require real clear leadership from the leaders that are there, and we all know that they're there. So I guess what I'm asking is if in your ample spare time you can do a little work on this.
One more question, and then we'll go to the panel. Yeah.
Okay. It's very heartening that so many people are agreeing that we need a new. We need a left party, that it should be socialist. But I would like to take issue with the point that Stanley made, and I was sure he was going to cut off after the last speaker because he would sense this.
Speak into the microphone when you're taking issue.
All right. Stanley raised the issue of state power and whether a left party should aim for state power. And it must be admitted that we are some distance from that. But nevertheless, if we're going to build a serious left party that ordinary people will you know, listen to what it says and react, yeah, that makes sense, then consider the following. We're all in favor of major change in the economic, political, and cultural structures of the U.S. and the world as they exist today. Presently, a small wealthy class owns and controls the means of production, and they run the state. Now, I don't understand how we can talk seriously about transforming that ownership to making it popular ownership, transforming the economic structures, the politics, while someone else is holding state power. And I think a large-scale society must have some kind of state, so I think a political party of the left will have to have as part of its strategy planning to eventually get to state power. I think a wrong conclusion has been drawn. Bill Fletcher mentioned that a key obstacle we face is the result of the failure of actually existing socialism. And many people, even on the left, concluded that socialism must be flawed because at first effort to build it was so flawed. Well, that first effort to build it also involved seizing state power. And I think many people have drawn a similar wrong conclusion that there's something wrong with taking state power. I think the problem was they took state power and didn't organize the new state in the right way, and they didn't organize the new socialism in the right way. And a new socialist party in the U.S., I think, will have to favor both a socialism done right and state power done right, and that will mean significant decentralization of power. It will mean that sovereignty will reside in the population, not in the top leadership. But that is a possible vision. People won't take us seriously if we talk about all these radical changes, but say we're not into that old-fashioned matter of taking state power.
I'm going to take the privilege of the chair and answer some of these questions, because some of them were directed to me, especially the last one, but and another one as well about the DSA and the CFC. Those who don't know history are doomed to relive it. That's George Santayana. That's a paraphrase. The problem that we have is that it's not a question of whether on the immediate agenda or even the long-term agenda, there doesn't have to be a discussion of the state and of the use of power. That's not the issue. The issue that's raised in Lenin's State and Revolution in 1917, which nobody likes to read because it's very uncomfortable. And what he says in State and Revolution is that the ultimate, and not only the ultimate, but the perspective of any kind of socialist transformation has to be the withering away of the state. The meaning of a dictatorship of the proletariat, you remember all this. The meaning of a dictatorship of the proletariat is it facilitates the end of the state, the end of subordination. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't want to get into the discussion of the dictatorship of the proletariat. It's gotten a bad name, but it's really a very interesting question that has to be addressed. Somebody said before, we have too many intellectuals, too much discussion. We haven't got any theory. Mm-hmm. Let's face it. One of our major problems is not that we don't have a multitude of practices. We're practicing all over the fucking place. But what we really don't have is a discussion of theoretical perspective, and I appreciate the last comment because I think it opens up that kind of a conversation. The second problem that we have is the problem of why not CFC and why the committees of correspondence and why not the DSA? I say this with a bit of shame, I was on the negotiating committee that brought the New American Movement and DSA together, and Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee together. We made a terrible mistake. I've said it in print. I'll say it over and over again. I am culpable for that mistake. And the reason was because we had two problems. The first problem was that New American Movement had a lot of people who were getting ready to get on with their lives, and they were tired and they were exhausted and they didn't want to be part of that socialist organization anymore. And the ones that did, the DSOC, were basically, with all due respect to the individuals who constituted it, some of whom are very honorable people, especially the late Michael Harrington, who was always straightforward social democrat, of a Trotskyist background, and decided that that's what he was becoming. The trouble with the DSA, the Democratic Socialist people, is that they were an annual dinner. So what about the committees of correspondence, the ex-Communist Party? We're going to have this new organization. I don't think it's not going to happen. And one of the things we're going to have is we're going to have tendencies. And those tendencies will have, I hope, the right to open up the historical discussions. I think one of the basic problems that we have in the reorganization of a political party is the discussion of the history of the Communist Party. We cannot avoid the history of the Communist Party because the Communist Party was the leading party of the left from 1934, 35 through the 1950s. Past the Khrushchev report of 1956. The legacy of that party is very complicated. Part of it was acquitted itself brilliantly in the organization of industrial workers in the 1934-35 to the 1937 period. And I can go through that history with you anytime you want.
because I know it almost day by day. No, I really do. But the problem at this point, is that when at a certain point they adopted the notion that they could be the left wing of the Democratic Party, that they could be the left wing of the New Deal, and they had those kinds of credentials building on the Organization of Industrial Workers, building on the unemployed movement, when they had those kind of credentials, and in that environment, we found ourselves without a left. That was a very serious problem. Small Trotskyist organizations, small anarchist organizations, but the CP was so powerful that it really did have that involvement. So we have to look at the United Front and the Popular Front, not as concept of the United Front, but as how it was actually practiced. And I believe the CFC has never learned that lesson. I think they continue over and over again, wonderful people, one of whom I organized as a high school student with. No, that's true. That's where I started my politics. That we have to re-examine that history. And upon re-examination, we cannot reproduce it. We have to learn from it and therefore create a different kind of party. I want to also say, finally, that if we were going to have a national newspaper in all of its forms, which, and I was a columnist for The Guardian when it, well, we did have a national newspaper from 1968 to 70. Some of you may even have read my stuff. If we're going to have a national newspaper in all of its forms, electronic as well as hard copy, and magazines and journals and publications, because the publishing industry is going out of business and we're going to have a left to revive it. I'm serious. We all know this, those of us who write books. And we're going to have... And if we're going to have think tanks, as somebody mentioned, you're going to have a political formation that's able to support them. Otherwise, what you're going to do is you're going to end up going to the rich and the filthy rich to get those kinds of institutions. And we can't afford those people anymore, because those are the people who told us, and every foundation, left, right, and center, now says, we don't want theory, we don't want conversation, we don't want the kind of examination that you want. What we want is action. And I remember the action faction in the SDS, which is less talk, more action. And those were the people who helped destroy the thing and prepared the grounds for the Marxist-Leninist bullshit that went on after that. I use that word Marxist-Leninist in quotes. I don't mean it necessarily. So what I'm saying is that if you're going to build an organization, a serious organization in this country, and you're going to do it, those debates have to go on at the highest theoretical level. The highest theoretical level does not exclude practical activity. And I have to say this for myself. I just have stepped down as a member of the Executive Council of the Professional Staff Congress, a union of 20,000 people. I stepped down because I don't have the time to do that kind of activity right now. But the truth of the matter is that activity of trade union activism does not resolve any of the problems that we've had in this conversation. And we have to do something qualitatively different. Otherwise, we are going to disappear. And I don't think that's an impossibility. I agree with Bill. We'll always have a left of some kind, but it won't be the left that we need. Anybody? Yes, Barbara.
I wanted to say two things. The first is on the question of the state. It seems to me that this tends to come up in two ways on the left. The first is the question of, do we envision a state under a socialist society? And the second is, what about a relationship to the state now? In other words, participation in electoral politics, putting pressure on the government, that kind of thing. I'm not sure we're going to agree on these issues. On the issue of will there be a state under a socialist society after the revolution, my question is, I would say, you know, how are you going to have a national health system? How do you have social security and so forth? It seems to me that on that level, obviously, there has to be a state of a very different sort. I think on the first question, I think that one of the ways in which the left of the late 60s marginalized itself was by the contemptuous attitude of many people in it, not all, towards the state and towards participation in the electoral arena. While we were regarding elections with contempt, for most Americans, elections were the main contact with politics. And I think one of the main things we have to avoid is that kind of self-congratulatory marginalization in whatever movement we build. Now, on the question of membership, somebody said, well, the problem with membership organizations is they don't work. And it is true that there's a lot of evidence that membership organizations don't work. My sense is that we might have to rethink what a membership organization means. My impression in the Bay Area is that there are very large numbers of people who are anxious to participate in some kind of left socialist organization. They tend to be reluctant to become members of it because they don't know what that's going to mean, but they want to come to meetings, they want to participate in discussions, they may want to be involved in projects, and they're not necessarily reluctant to give money. And so it may be that we can find some new form in which we have a center of people who are willing to make an ongoing commitment and a very vigorous effort to reach out to those on the periphery and bring them in to the extent that they're willing to be brought in. My sense of the Committees of Correspondence and DSA, again from the Bay Area, is that neither of those organizations have any vitality. So leaving aside what we may think of the perspectives and programs of either of those organizations, I just don't think it works. I don't think that joining those organizations would make any difference. The last thing I want to say is that I think the kinds of debates that we're having now about the state, membership, and so forth are very important, but I think we have to keep it firmly in mind that if we are able to build a socialist organization, that we have to vigorously avoid efforts towards ideological purity. Many of us are going to go on disagreeing with each other about these issues, and we cannot drive people out because they disagree on one issue or another. We have to include people who range from anarchists through Marxists through people who reject both traditions, and we have to keep an eye on what it is we're trying to accomplish and allow for many different vocabularies and many different cultural forms within that arena. The last thing that I would say is...
That's the last thing before the last.
Yeah, okay. But one more is I think that the environment has to be everybody's second issue. That means that we don't want to discourage people from working on the issues that are of primary importance to them, but I think that the environmental crisis is fundamental, and therefore we have to make a special effort to link everything to the question of the environment.
Two things. One, the speaker that raised a question about secessionism and about New York and Washington, I'm not sure whether he was misunderstood, and I don't want to go there, but I think that he was raising something very important, which is that there's a long history in the United States of right-wing populism, which is vehemently anti-Jewish, and which postulates this idea, as I mentioned before, about a Zionist occupation of government and various kinds of conspiracy theories. That movement is sort of like herpes, right? It is, right? It's in the system, and every so often it pops up, and it pops up at some of the worst times. See where I'm going? So we've got this situation, and the right-wing populism is the current, I was saying to someone earlier, there's a certain kind of revanchism that's emerging, revenge, that is really linked with right-wing populism right now, that's furious with Obama, furious that there's a black person that's a president, furious about a whole set of things, but this is not new. That's the thing that we need to be clear about. When people are talking about Texas seceding or South Carolina seceding, this is not new. There's a long current of this because in some basic ways, the Civil War never ended. Second point is about building a party. there's a number of organizations like Solidarity, the Freedom Road Socialist Organization, that have spent an immense amount of time attempting to move discussions about the building of something new. And I don't want to put down DSA and CCDS. In fact, a right-wing website described me as a Maoist who was a leader of DSA, which was thought quite interesting. So I don't want to put them down, because I think in a lot of ways these organizations are attempting to hold the hilltop, right? And we're being bombarded, and they're attempting to hold the hilltop, and there's something that's very important about that. It's simply not enough. And part of what we're grappling with, I think, is a lack of urgency on the left, believe it or not. I think that most of us on the left actually think we can keep putting off organization, that we can keep studying issues, we can keep debating, and that eventually, spontaneously, the conditions will emerge and hit, here's Johnny, right? Out we walk. And that's not the way organizations get built, folks. They get built ultimately when some people decide on the basis of conditions and et cetera, they develop a strategy. In the absence of that, we will not have organization. So leaving this conference, part of what I think we should be doing is encouraging the debate about what's the minimum level of unity we need for an organization. That should be a debate. What's the minimum basis of unity we need in order to build a party for socialism? And I think that if there's a contribution a left forum could make, it would be to encourage that discussion and focus us so that we move from this abstraction to the concrete of putting something in place.
Mike?
In no particular order, responding to some of the things, I think what we have too much of is verbiage, but not enough good, shared, practical, usable theory. I think we have too much flowery values, but not enough institutional vision. And I think we have too much infatuation with tactics, particularly dealing with police clubs, and not enough strategic understanding. On the issue of reform, I think too many people look at reforms as not revolution and therefore bad, instead of looking at reforms as something that makes people's lives better, that addresses real pain and real suffering of real people and therefore good. And then we engage with it in a manner which leads towards what we want for the future. But to dismiss reform is to be callous and to become, it isn't even just disassociated, it is something much worse than that. This question of the state, I also think there's more than one way to look at this, and it's partly semantic. Suppose somebody said, we don't want an economy. We're going to have a withering away of the economy. Everybody in here would say, that's absurd. What are you talking about? You don't wither away the economy. On the other hand, we certainly don't want anything remotely like the economy we have. So what we're talking about is taking over the economy, that is to say, workers and consumers controlling the economy in a completely new fashion. Well, it's the same for the state. It's not so much that we're not going to have a polity, a political system. We're going to have adjudication. We're going to have shared program. We're going to have legislation of some kind. We're going to do it in a completely new way. So as soon as we see it that way, we see that in acting inside the state, we're moving toward the thing we want. We're doing reforms inside the state that move toward what we want and that raise desires for it. Finally, the issue of organization and how hard it is and so on. I do think that it's not us who, it's not the people who aren't joining the organizations who are wrong. It's the people who create organizations that nobody wants to join who are wrong. It's not the people who don't like what we say that are wrong. It's the people who say things that aren't likable. I mean, we have to begin to realize that. And so what's wrong with our organizations is that they don't meet needs of their members. They don't help people feel better about themselves, feel more empowered, have control over what it is that we're doing, even know what we're fighting for. And I think that's because our organizations historically aren't really fighting for a new world. So they don't.
Listen, it's 2:00, people, and I think the problem is that we have to get out of here. So, thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm ending how I ended.